This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 6th of October, these are our main stories. Huge blasts light up southern Beirut as Israel continues its war against Hezbollah. Donald Trump returns for a rally at the ground where he narrowly avoided an assassin's bullet in July. Doctors in the Democratic Republic of Congo have begun the country's first vaccination campaign against Mpox. Also in this podcast... Squeezed out! Is it the end for one of the last accordion makers in France? We start in Beirut, where over the past few hours there have been huge explosions. Red and orange flames shot up into the night sky. The powerful blasts happened soon after the Israeli military warned people to evacuate areas in South Beirut, where Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah was killed just over a week ago. BBC Persian's Nafisa Konavard is in Beirut.
We have heard at least 10 very loud airstrikes. I can see from my balcony that a cloud of smoke is rising above southern suburb of Beirut. Two loud explosions first came from the area that is very close to the airport, and the rest came from different locations around southern suburb of Beirut. Right now, just before I start talking to you, there was another loud explosion that I think, as I see on social media, almost half of the city heard that explosion. And I still see that a part of southern suburb of Beirut is burning whatever has been hit. It's very thick clouds of smoke I see above it.
Yes, we saw pictures of that massive blast that you say was heard across the city. Just explain the area that has been targeted again.
The area is known as Dahiyeh, which is in Arabic means southern suburb, and it is known also as a Hezbollah stronghold, but it's a very packed residential area. But just before this airstrike, IDF, Israeli Defense Ministry and Army, they released a statement warning residents to leave some locations. At least 9 locations were pointed on the map that it was posted on X by IDF spokesperson, asking people to evacuate. But right after, like 1 hour after explosions happened, this is becoming regular and routine for nights here in Beirut. First, we are hearing a very heavy drone buzzing overhead, and it is not only above, these drones are not only flying above the locations that are known as stronghold of Hezbollah. They are all over the city, over different parts of the city. And right after, there are warning by Israeli army, and then explosions after explosions, exactly on these hours near midnight.
Nafisa Konavard speaking to my colleague Nikki Schiller. The Israeli military has said that it's killed 440 Hezbollah fighters since it launched its ground operation in southern Lebanon on Monday. The army added that 30 were commanders with the Iranian-backed group and that it's pushing Hezbollah further north into Lebanon. Israel has said the aim of its offensive in Lebanon is to stop Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel so that civilians can safely return to their homes. However, Israeli airstrikes over the past few weeks have, according to the head of the United Nations Refugee Agency, left Lebanon facing a terrible crisis with more than 1 million people displaced. Filippo Grandi is asking the international community to provide more aid to support the humanitarian effort there. Lebanon's finance minister, Amin Salam, said that his country was being punished.
Well, so far, I mean, I wouldn't really categorize this war against Hezbollah. As Minister of Economy, I can tell you this war is against Lebanon. I mean, it's very clear that everything that is being hit brings the country down. And we're talking about 2,000 civilians being killed so far. They are destroying an entire country.
Now the Jewish New Year and the Sabbath are over, expectation is rising that Israel will, as promised, retaliate against Iran after the Islamic Republic launched a barrage of missiles at the Jewish state last Tuesday. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that his country's military was destroying large parts of Hezbollah's arsenal while preparing for an attack on Iran.
Twice already, Iran has fired and we have intercepted hundreds of missiles from one of the largest ballistic missile attacks in history. No country in the world would accept such an attack on its cities and citizens, and Israel will not accept it either. Israel has the duty and the right to defend itself and to respond to these attacks, and we will do so.
Monday will mark a year since Hamas attacked southern Israel, and Israelis who lived near Gaza are still dispersed and traumatized. Kibbutz Bayuri suffered more deaths than any other single community on October the 7th. 101 people were killed. The BBC's Alice Cuddy has been back to speak to some of the people she met just after the attacks.
They were on the roof, so they could see who's running in this direction, who's running in this direction, and they could shoot all over.
Daphne Gerstner returned to Berry with her best friend, Shea Guttentag.
So basically everything here was destroyed.
Yeah.
Almost every house is burned.
Around 2 o'clock, all the terrorists from there saw there's a really...
A killing zone, so they came and started shooting
and killed everyone.
And these are like a memorial for the people.
Yeah, and all the broken pieces. This is part of the vehicle. It just melted.
She showed us the wreckage of her father's home, which was stormed by Hamas fighters on October 7th. I first met them just after the attacks. Daphne's father hid in the safe room for hours as the house burnt down around him. Her brother was one of those killed trying to defend the kibbutz.
The IDF did not come here. It was only the people from the kibbutz.
And they always had a feeling the army is near, the army is coming, they're going to save us, and they had like this hope. But actually, they had no chance.
They give one hell of a fight, your brother. They are heroes.
A crumpled graduation certificate, a charred board game. In the kitchen there's a burned fridge freezer full of decayed food. That's the boom of bombs landing in Gaza, a reminder of the war that was started that day. You can still smell the burning here, can't you?
Yeah.
And it's been almost a year.
Yeah, you asked me before about the last year, how was it? It's between coping with the personal trauma and grieving for the dead people, and at the same time to fight for the hostages to come back, everything together. And I think people didn't get to really grieve for their loved one because there are so many.
After the 7th, this area was a military zone. You couldn't bury here, so buried elsewhere.
Rami Gold walks me through the graveyard after the funeral of the family killed on October 7th. Parents and their two children. This was just one of many.
Now, because the October 7th is coming, so I'd like to have them all back home so I can have the ceremonies here. So as far as the community is concerned, bring the deceased here to rebury them in Be'eri, it means we're coming home. And tomorrow there's another one. Next week, every other day, there's another one.
Does it still feel as raw as it did when you attended the funerals last October?
No, it isn't. Although, when you face it, it's just as hard.
Rami is one of the few residents who moved back to Berry after the attacks to try to rebuild the community. For many, trauma means it's too soon to return. Hundreds of Berry's residents have moved to a temporary community about 40 minutes away. One of them is Shea. I met up with her again on the day she and her two daughters moved in.
A new adventure, a new chapter. Yeah, it's about time.
Does it feel like you've kind of come a long way since?
Everything needs adjustments. We're not at home. We're always fighting for the hostages to come. Everything is about the 7th. And we're trying to keep our heads up and live.
Shea Guttentag there, ending that report by Alice Cuddy. Let's now hear from the other side of the border in Gaza. The BBC's Christina Volk has been in almost daily contact with several young people in the Palestinian territory as Israel's war against Hamas rages on. One of them is Sanabel, who told her story to the BBC through WhatsApp messages.
For me, the worst part of the war is when I heard these plans, I was crying sadly. I was also too fighting. Also, I hate these plans too much because they were the reason of killing my Aunt Ola and my uncles.
This is Sanabel. She's now 17. After the Israeli invasion into Gaza began in the wake of the October the 7th attacks, she and her family remained in Gaza City, in the north of the Strip. This is the first message she sent me on Saturday, October 14th.
When people ask me where is my biggest fear, I was always answer living in wars. I'm terrified to lose my family, my home, in addition my dreams and my ambitions.
A year ago, she was a high school student, dreaming of becoming an English translator and traveling the world. Now, the sounds of explosions and gunfire have become part of her daily life. She recorded this on her phone when she was hiding in her grandmother's house in Gaza City. Sanabel stayed in touch with me as much as possible in those first few months, but she often wasn't able to access the internet or phone signal. In those times, Sanabel's aunt Ola kept me updated about Sanabel's well-being. This is the last voice message Ola sent on Thursday, November 9th.
Situation very, very, very difficult, very horrible. Sanabel go to her grandma, her aunt killed, and her two of children of my family.
That was 2 months into the conflict. Sanabel was trying to stay positive in those first few months, focusing on helping her family. Then, in late November, her aunt Ola was killed. Sanabel sent me this message just after.
I can't do anything. I can't do anything, just the word to stop the war. We are really fed up. I can't do anything. Just pray for us, please. I can't. Maybe I'm going to lose my dream, my families. I can't.
Around June, Sanabel and her 16-year-old sister learned that they are among the tens of thousands of Gazans who contracted hepatitis A during the conflict. In their case, it was because of the unclean water they had to drink.
I have a headache and my temperature is too high.
Throughout the ordeal, Sanabel has done her best to comfort her little sister, who's only 4 years old.
Dad. To reduce my little sister's fear about the war, we play together, laugh and draw. She always cries she wants apple, and here in Gaza there are no food, vegetables, fruit. So I'm trying to let her forget what she wants.
On Monday, September 16, Sanabel and her family got some small comfort from one of the aid convoys that was able to get into Gaza City.
We have a chicken, so we really like, it feel like I'm really over the moon. My little sister, finally she will eat and healthy food.
Sanabel and her family are still in Gaza City. Though with constant drones overhead and the constant threat of airstrikes, they want to leave. They have no idea where to go, though. She sent me this clip just over a week ago, on September 25th.
We miss everything. This war ends everything, and our dreams, our ambitions. But we also trying to find a way to keep living.
The voice of Sanabel in Gaza. Israel is not allowing international journalists from media organisations, including the BBC, independent access to Gaza. It's 1 month to the US presidential election, and Donald Trump has held another rally in the swing state of Pennsylvania, but not just anywhere, in the city of Butler, where he was injured in an assassination attempt in July. The Republican candidate hoping for a second term, told the crowd that he would make America great again, MAGA, and he remained unbowed.
Exactly 12 weeks ago this evening on this very ground, a cold-blooded assassin aimed to silence me and to silence the greatest movement, MAGA, in the history of our country. MAGA. We love MAGA. For 16 harrowing seconds during the gunfire, time stopped as this vicious monster unleashed pure evil from his sniper's perch, not so far away. But by the hand of Providence and the grace of God, that villain did not succeed in his goal, did not come close.
Among the people there are the tech billionaire and Tesla boss Elon Musk, his first appearance at a Trump rally, and the family of Corey Comparatore, who was killed in the shooting in July. Our correspondent Will Grant is also there.
As you've been hearing there, Donald Trump trying to give the impression that he's just picking up where he left off. Sort of, I think, it hugely symbolic that he's back in Butler. And certainly his camp are keen for him to be making this show of strength, as they would see it, projecting an image of sort of fearlessness with, as you said at the very beginning, just a month to go before voting day. And it's certainly been an event that's been attended by many, many of those who were there 2 months ago and others who were motivated to come as a result of what happened that day, who felt that they should turn out and show their support for his bid for the White House too.
Security measures presumably rather stepped up.
Yeah, noticeably so. First and foremost, former President Trump is speaking to the crowd from behind bulletproof glass. That didn't happen that day, obviously. There is Secret Service agents posted in a whole host of places around what is a widened security perimeter. There is a single command centre as opposed to two separate ones between local law enforcement and Secret Service personnel on the day where the assassination attempt took place. So an attempt to account for some of the failings that led to that incident.
And they're in Butler County because it's in Pennsylvania.
And it is so important in that regard. This is a swing state, and so many of the swing states are within the margin of error in the most recent polls. Quite clearly, former President Trump thinks this state is still to play for. He thinks that an event like this, with just weeks to go, can still make an impact. The idea of returning to the place where he almost lost his life, within a whisker of losing his life, is a powerful image, and certainly it's well attended. People have been here since very, very early in the morning to get a place and are now listening to President Trump speak.
Will Grant. And staying with the US election, here's a message from Oliver Conway.
Hi all, just a quick reminder that in the run-up to the US presidential election, we'll be doing a special podcast in collaboration with our friends at BBC Americast. But we need your help to come up with questions to put to the team in the US. So if there's anything you'd like to know, please send us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or tweet us at Global News Pod. And if possible, please record your question in a voice note. Thank you.
Oliver Conway. It's as unthinkable as England without roast beef or Switzerland without alpenhorns. France is facing the loss of one of its last makers of accordions. The firm, Morgier, recently announced that it has been placed into liquidation. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, reports.
It's not the only nation to have fallen under its spell. But France certainly clasped the accordion close to its heart. Perennially versatile, it's graced everything from popular dances and the chanson of Edith Piaf. To French spins on classical, tango and jazz. It's not just the preserve of professional musicians either. One devotee, former French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, once said if all politicians played the accordion, they'd get on better. A lesson, perhaps, for the current discordant crop. Morgier's sales were hit by cheaper Chinese imports, and it never recovered from the COVID economic downturn. One manufacturer, Cavagnolo, remains. Its director, Mathieu Chaussalet, said it was sad to see a competitor close, as it could send a negative signal as regards the instrument. He remains upbeat, however.
The French accordion is not dead, and it's up to us to make it more relevant to today's tastes, to give it a more modern image, to make it interesting for young people. We also need to provide instruments that are easier to use, that are lighter, more manageable than we were capable of making 50 years ago.
His company is making accordions with carbon fibre bodies and has introduced digital versions. And although most of its market remains resolutely French, he says, it exports too, even to China. Play on.
Danny Eberhardt reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
I never thought it was fair that athletes can't look good. A woman has a duty to look as attractive as possible.
The Italian who brought style to the tennis court. Since the beginning of this year, Mpox has spread to 15 countries across Africa. The Democratic Republic of Congo is at the centre of the current outbreak. On Saturday, the authorities there have begun a vaccination campaign in the east. This is the DRC's first Mpox vaccination programme as it battles an outbreak that has killed nearly 1,000 people this year, 70% of them children under five. There are more than 30,000 cases. The Africa regional editor is Richard Kigoi.
The vaccination is taking place in eastern DRC. It starts off in the city of Goma, which is the regional capital of North Kivu province, which is the epicenter of the outbreak of the Mpox virus. What is happening right now, the vaccination is very targeted. So they're looking at people who are at high risk of infection. So they're looking at people who are sick or who have pre-existing conditions. They're looking at people who do cross-border trade because there's lots of movement between DR Congo and the neighboring countries. And also health workers are very critical because they have been on the front line, and also people who consider to be sex workers. So it's very specific. It's very targeted for now because there are very little resources in terms of doses for vaccination.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Because this may be targeted at the moment, but there are millions of people who need to be vaccinated.
And that's why the authorities in DR Congo have also reached out to Japan, where they've got a company or manufacturer that is involved in production of vaccines. And what is happening right now is that they have got the approval, which they can produce doses that can be used to vaccinate children. Because if you listen to the minister's press conference on Friday, he's says that about 70% of the deaths are for people or children who are under the age of five. So that's going to be the benefit. They have made appeals to countries, especially in Europe and the United States, who are hoarding, you know, doses of vaccines during the 2022 global outbreak. So then they can be able to vaccinate much of the population.
Meanwhile, efforts are being stepped up to contain a Marburg virus outbreak in Rwanda.
They have increased screening and contact tracing, especially at points of entry, the borders with surrounding countries, and also at the main international airport in Kigali. They have imposed restrictions in terms of movement. Hospital visits, especially for suspected cases, have been banned because about 80% of the people who have been infected and those who have died are comprised of health workers who are actually infected while working at intensive care units. They have also restricted visits to boarding schools, which normally take place on a monthly basis. And they have urged a lot of people, really, for those who have displayed any symptoms to suggest that they could be suffering or have been infected by Marburg virus to come out and take themselves to hospital. So there's been lots of risk communication that has been done across the country, and a sensitization that is taking place. And also surrounding countries as well have heightened surveillance, especially at the points of entry and exits.
Richard Kigoi. Italy is the country with the largest number of World Heritage sites recognised by the United Nations cultural body, UNESCO. They date from the time of the Romans and the Greeks, the Renaissance and the Baroque. Could architecture dating from Italy's more recent fascist past now join the list? The possibility has sparked a row in Parliament, as Isabella Jewell reports.
Rome's Colosseum, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and the ruins of Pompeii. All monuments in Italy with UNESCO recognition and protection. But now one MP is looking to put Latina on the map, a town south of Rome. Giovanna Miele from the hard right League Party has proposed that UNESCO grants the fascist and rationalist architecture of the town World Heritage status. The motion is being studied by the Culture Commission in Italy's parliament and could be voted on later this month. Latina is one of the country's youngest cities, founded by the former fascist dictator Benito Mussolini in 1932. Ms. Miele, who was born there, said the parliamentary motion is inspired by the uniqueness of Latina, not for its fascist origins, but for its rationalist architecture. But politicians on the left have criticised the idea. Laura Baldrini, a leading member of the centre-left Democratic Party, said it would be an attempt to rewrite history. Elisabetta Piccolotti, an MP in the Green and Left Alliance, accused the governing coalition of Prime Minister Meloni as having a fixation with the country's fascist past. This week, the upper house of the Italian Parliament, the Senate, approved plans for the 100-year anniversary celebrations of Latina's foundation by Mussolini, which is coming up in 8 years' time.
Isabella Jewell. Police in Pakistan have arrested at least 30 people following a day of demonstrations in Islamabad. This is the second day of the latest in a series of anti-government rallies by supporters of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan calling for his release from prison. Despite sealing off the capital with shipping containers and cutting phone and mobile internet services, police used tear gas to break up the demonstrators. Mohsin Naqvi is Pakistan's interior minister.
We will not allow these protesters to cross the line, but unfortunately they are. I'm warning them not to, but they're not listening. We don't want to take extreme measures to stop them, but there is no sign they're listening.
Mr. Khan's PTI say that police have detained one of their most prominent leaders, Ali Amin Gandapur. It says officers forced their way into his official residence in Islamabad. Here's our correspondent Farhat Javid.
Imran Khan had given a call and asked his supporters to come out and protest not only against his imprisonment, but also some constitutional amendments that government wants to bring in. So his protesters actually started from the northwestern province under the leadership of the chief minister, Amin Gandapur. As the announcement came out and as the protesters started off their journey, all the entry and exit points of the capital were locked by the government. They somehow managed to enter Islamabad. And when they reached there, police started tear gas shelling and stone pelting. And protesters were also pelting stones at police. Dozens of PTI protesters were also arrested. In the meantime, what was very strange, a chief minister left his protesters and he went to the official residence. As he reached there, we saw that police and paramilitary forces surrounded his official residence. And since then, he is inside the residence and no media or any other person is allowed to go in or meet him.
How's Imran Khan organizing this so effectively? He's in prison, isn't he?
Yes, Imran Khan remains in jail and the hearings continue. But at the same time, Imran Khan is immensely popular among his supporters. Imran Khan's influence over his party, it remains strong and his supporters continue to push for his release.
And this man who may or may not have been arrested, Ali Amin Gandapur, he's a key supporter of Imran Khan, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Ali Amin Gandapur, who is the chief minister of Pakistan's northwestern province, he is a key supporter of Imran Khan. Remember that northwestern province is the only province in Pakistan which is being ruled by Imran Khan's party. So they have a very strong position there. So Gandapur has been at the forefront of all these demonstrations and his role has drawn significant attention as well. authorities have been accusing him of not only coordinating all these protests, but also being directly involved in the clashes between protesters and security forces.
Briefly, it sounds like the election of 8 months ago didn't really sort everything out.
Pakistan is experiencing heightened political instability. Imran Khan's supporters are actively protesting against the government. Their protests begin long before general election, but we have seen an intensity after the election because they are alleging that the election, they were rigged. And also at a time when Pakistan is already going through an economic crisis.
Farhat Javid. Before Martina Navratilova, Margaret Court and Billie Jean King were the first female superstars of tennis, there was Lea Pelicoli, who has died at the age of 89. An Italian, she left her mark on the sport in the 1950s and 60s with her striking outfits. She once told a British newspaper, "I became famous because of my clothes, not my playing." Anna O'Neill looks back on Lea Pelicoli's career.
From miniskirts to school uniforms, the scene is just as much one of fashion as of sport.
With her extravagant on-court outfits trimmed with huge bows, ostrich feathers and even diamonds, Lea Pelicoli was a style icon during her sporting career, nicknamed La Divina or The Divine by her fans. Born in 1935 in Milan, Pelicoli was Italy's top female tennis player for 14 years, between 1959 and 1976. She reached the fourth round of Wimbledon three times and was one of the first women to wear what has now become the dress standard for female players, the miniskirt. Speaking to the Italian broadcaster Rai in 2021, she said her skirts were often measured for decency, but she felt it was important to look good.
I never thought it was fair that athletes can't look good. A woman has a duty to look as attractive as possible. I needed to have a certain elegance to be accepted in a way.
She will be remembered as much for the emancipation of women through fashion as for her sporting prowess.
Anna O'Neill. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Wilfen and the producer was Daniel Mann. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.